Thank you, everyone, for coming. I want to echo the sentiments that Ellie mentioned. We want to thank the Schellers and of course, all of our hosts. First, the Spetners and then the Laymans. And we thank the Hellers for offering their house. And we thank them for realizing ahead of time that they felt that it wouldn't be big enough. And telling us at the beginning of the week that they felt they couldn't host. And we certainly thank the Schellers for hosting, especially on such late notice. Please come sit down.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
So we thank you very, very much for hosting, especially on such late notice, and preparing such a beautiful spread. This way, even if the shear falls flat, people will still have had a good time. This is the third and final part of the series. As I was trying to cram in everything into this series, you'll see this is a 6-page book, which I believe is a page bigger or two than the previous books each. So we had about 15 or 16 pages in our 3 lectures of notes. I realized, which I probably knew ahead of time, which is that this is more than a 3-part series, but we try to focus on enough major issues to get into 3 parts. And what I'll do briefly before we start tonight is to just summarize the salient points, especially of last week, and in particular as they will relate to tonight's lecture. Also, just to remind everyone that as we had in the previous 2 weeks, the expectation is that the lecture will be an hour and 15 minutes. Basically, we started 2 weeks ago discussing the events of the early 1960s. The fact that at that time, there was a great spirit towards ecumenism on the part of the Catholic Church, and their attempt to reevaluate their own historical theology towards the Jewish community. And as a result, they had a whole conference which was known as Vatican II. And this was going on for a few years in the beginning, early part of the 60s, at which, at different points, they invited various members of the Jewish community to either come as observers or, in fact, be part of dialogue. And we saw that historically there was much interest on the part of many non-Orthodox Jews and even some Orthodox Jews to be participant in it. And in particular, the locus of the invitation for the Orthodox community went to Rav Soloveitchik. And even before he made any major declarations, he had already made certain decisions with turning down initial invitations. We saw last week, even for example, how the head then of the ADL in the World Jewish Congress, fellow Dr. Goldman, who desperately wanted to go. I think Rav Lichtenstein's line was, didn't want to walk, but wanted to run to the Vatican. But in the end, because the Rav said not to do it, and they didn't want to fracture the unity within the Jewish community, if this valuable and significant part of the Orthodox community wasn't going to do it, actually, at least for a while, people listened. And basically, at an RCA conference in 1964, the Midwinter Conference of February 1964, the Rav gave a major address in which he discussed these issues and spoke about why he was against interreligious Jewish-Catholic dialogue. And later that year, in that issue of the Journal Tradition, he published in a written form the essay that he had given at the conference, entitled it Confrontation. We spent the first week of this series learning through some of the highlights of the essay of Confrontation, where the Rav had, again, we won't go over now, the beautiful drush and language and biblical exegesis from the first part of the essay. But when it came to the second part of the essay, he basically had a number of arguments to buttress his following 2-part position. His 2-part position was that he was against any religious or theological dialogue with, whether it be the Catholic Church or by extension, any other religion. But, and this is an important but, which we'll be focusing on at some point towards the end of today's lecture, we haven't done much of yet, the but was that he was in favor of working with, if not dialoguing, but even more than that, working with members of any other faith, including the Catholic Church, on issues which he called social or moral issues. And even though he was aware that obviously a social issue, when he talked about war, poverty, abortion, he mentioned a few examples in the essay, obviously invite a rabbi or a priest to that discussion. They're not coming as sociologists or psychologists or economists. They're going to be coming as people of faith. They're going to be speaking in their own theological language. Nevertheless, he was okay with that. In terms of why he was against theological or religious discussions, there's a number of arguments that were written for in the essay itself. One of the big philosophical arguments he made was an idea which we spent a lot of time last week analyzing, was the idea that every faith community, every religion is so fundamentally unique that he felt it's literally impossible, it's futile on some level, to try to have the communication on certain types of issues. He had other fears as well, and one of the big issues, which we spent some time discussing last week, was the fact that even though it never makes its way into the lines or to the words of the essay itself, in between the lines, it's possible to detect, and many such reports subsequently mention the fact that he also had an additional fear, and that was that he didn't fully trust them. He didn't fully trust their motives. He thought that there was a significant fear of missionizing, and what we call in halachic terminology, shmad, of apostasy. So that was a large part of the essay itself and some of the discussions. Last week we primarily focused on a lot of the impact that he had. We saw a lot of secondary literature, and we also spent the second half of last week's lecture discussing some of the critics of the essay, those who have written published articles where they were critical both in theory and in practice of the position. We saw those who therefore rejected the position, even with the Orthodox community. We saw those who cast aspersions that he was really just insecure, and the more or less the quote was that he was looking over his right shoulder. What will they say about him in Brisk? We disagreed and dismissed both of those analyses. And ultimately, the analysis that we decided to accept, again, which was echoed by a number of people, including Dr. David Berger, was an idea that even though some of these social or moral issues fundamentally are going to have religious language, again, if you want to use the metaphor of an onion, so the whole onion is part of religious life, but those are issues that are more on the outer layers of the onion. And it was those innermost, most intimate issues of religion and spirituality which he felt were the ones which were incommunicable, and to the extent that even you could talk about them, he felt were inappropriate. There was another fear that he had, which is addressed in the essay, and will make up a large part of tonight's lecture, and that was a fear that he had, what I will call, and he alluded to, reciprocity. Namely, that if the church will make certain moves in their own history or theology, we really don't think this about you. We really don't believe that you ever did this, etc., etc. The fear was that, if you want to have polite etiquette, and at least to, you know, amongst ourselves we're not always so polite, but usually, klapei chutz, Jews were polite people. People will make all these nice, gracious moves to you. It's only natural that you should be expected and want to reciprocate. And that was a significant fear, and we're going to discuss a lot of that tonight. But before we do so, please, everyone come in. Someone has to sit in this chair. Might as well be you. Maybe you should sit next, no one else will. Okay. But you have to be in a way that I could see you. I don't know what you're making faces behind
me. I'm going
to
do the sign.
Okay. Okay. I want to start off the shiur proper tonight by, we spoke a little bit about Rav Moshe Feinstein in previous weeks, but we didn't really fully engage him. And I want to start off the shiur, if you look at your first page of your handouts, with two tshuvas by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, the dates, especially of the second one, are significant. But the first tshuva is written on March 1st, 1967. That's 3 years after the Rav's essay has come out, the position has been known, and now apparently there are some conferences going on. If you look at who was the shoel, who asked the question to Rav Moshe, Dr. Bernie Lander, the founder of Toro College, now of Lander's yeshiva. At one point he was a candidate for the presidency of Yeshiva University, a very major player in the Orthodox world, certainly in the last 50 years or so. And he, at the time, was invited, as Rav Moshe, you can glean from the Rav Moshe's response, he was part of the RCA. I don't want to get into the issue now, but as many of you may be familiar, the RCA and the OU were part of what was then called the Synagogue Council. And as Orthodox representatives, he was planning on attending a certain interreligious conference. He was planning himself on going. And I don't know if he was getting criticism or he just himself had doubts. He wrote a letter of Moshe 4 days before the conference. What should he do? And the response of Rav Moshe is very telling. If you look on the right-hand column of the first page, he talks about here, if you see the second line, I'm not even sure exactly how to pronounce those in Rav Moshe's Yiddishized Hebrew, but that's Catholics and Protestants. And the second line, right? Catholicin. Catholics and Protestants. Yachad and B'nai Yisrael, Mechevre Synagogue Council, Gam Chaverim Rabbanim, Histadrus Rabbanim, that's the RCA. Ah, Shemash Yedaber Kvotaroso, even though what you're telling me, what parts are you going to be involved in? Yeah, Bemili de Alma, an important code word. Not theological dialogue, but you're going to be involved in social, religious discussions. Pashut u baroshu iser chomer shlab Yisrael de Vodazara. Moshe Feinstein says you absolutely cannot be involved in any such discussion. It's absolutely prohibited. You're even coming close, even on some level, to Avodah Zarah. Obviously, he's referring to Christianity as Avodah Zarah. This is a terrible thing. Pashta Hamagefa. This plague has spread out. Baharbe Makomos, etc., etc. He refers then to the current pope. Asher Kol Kavanoso. This is an important point. Kol Kavanoso Hu Lahavir Es Kol Yehudi Me'emunasam HaTahora HaKadosha. Moshe's estimation, the entire focus of all of the ecumenism of the Catholic Church was for one thing, to convert Jews. Listen to this, it's an unbelievable line. She yoser noach lahavir ba'ofan zeh, because they have made a strategic decision, that it'll be easier for them to seduce and convert Jews in this way, ba'ofan hasina haritzichus sheishtamshu, again, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce that word, but he basically means the church and the Pope, Shalafana. For years, they've been coming after us with hatred and priest, killing us.
Priesthood.
Thank you.
Priesthood.
Actually, there's no race. There's no race, though. There's no race. Papists. Multiple popes. Pope Loshon Rabin. Okay? So we know the history of the Jewish-Christian relationship has been a bloody one in one direction for millennia. Says Rav Moshe, all that's going on now is they're trying to kill us with kindness. Again, I'm not trying to draw an exact comparison, but by analogy, certainly this is what many people have been worried was the whole Oslo phenomenon, right? That they say one thing in Arabic, they say one thing in English. Really, the whole point is they realize this is what's called the phase plan. Again, this is not the topic of tonight's lecture, but it's eerily parallel in terms of the fear that they tried to kill us in a frontal attack for all these years, and now they're trying to seduce us with love. This is what Rav Moshe says is going on. Therefore, he says any involvement in it is usur and terrible. Any rabbi who gets involved in it violates the isur of meisus u'meidiach. You're bringing other Jews away, even though he says you'll have good intentions, you won't try to do anything bad. It'll be perceived in the wrong way. It will lead other people to do wrong things. It's all bad. We skip a few lines. He says, what will happen to this? Yilamdu mizahar be'anashim lelech l'drashos. They'll go to all of these things, they'll hear from other religions, it'll be a terrible thing. Anything, any pagisha imam, any meeting with them, it's all terrible. The next word, demasha amlu, this is missionizing of the Catholics. Ko hashanim, all of this that they've tried to do over the years, lo olam yodam bak mat ma'at. All right, we have a history, we've died at the stake rather than giving in. All that they've tried to do over the years, it has had limited impact. Therefore, now, chas v'sholom, aydei rabbonim, chesrei das. All of these simple-minded rabbis who are agreeing to participate will be making this terrible mistake. Ki'ilu sherozim hushtateif imahem efshar, shishtamdu aydei ze harbe yoter. This will lead to a greater plague. There'll be more assimilation, if you will, by our participating in this than there were in all the years where we knew it was an enemy and we fought them. Ve'ein tonim lemesis, we can't help them, no excuses. Lomer shlonis kaivin lezeh. Nothing, it doesn't work. He ends off in the last paragraph. You shouldn't feel bad that you're canceling 4 days before the convention. Rav Moshe is a practical man. But he says, too bad. Some things are so important you can't go. This was the English date. You'll see this is, look at the Hebrew date of this. Yud Tes Adar Rishon. That was March 1st, 1967. If I'm not mistaken. Yes. Look, in the published Igros Moshe, under the same heading in terms of the Siman, it's Chelek Gimel, Siman Mem Gimel, he has a chelek beis. This is Tes Adar Sheni. That's 3 weeks later, or in English, March 21st, 1967. Rav Moshe was agitated about this. 3 weeks later, he sends a letter to. 3 weeks later, Malas Kvo Teraso, Sher Besari, my relative, Yedidi Vechavivi, my friend and my beloved, Hagon Hagadol Hamafursa, Marbitz Torah Barabim, of Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Because he knows what the. Again, let's just think about it for a moment. When Bernie Lander is apparently going to this conference planning on discussing only mili da'alma, only social political things, where do you think he got that from? Either directly or indirectly, he obviously got that. Those were the guidelines of Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Moshe, I assume on some level, if he didn't read Confrontation, he was aware, for all we know, Bernie Lander told him. So Rav Moshe disagreed, apparently. And now, 3 weeks later, Rav Moshe is going to the Rav directly. Sends a letter to the Rav. And he tells him about this thing. This thing, this terrible thing, Ezer Rabbani Mehatzi'irim, it's the young rabbis. You know, it's always the younger generation. Terrible, they're going to go with the church and this academic convention. you see in parentheses, that's ecumenism. They're going to go for this whole thing. They're going to be talking. Asher Kavanaso, again, Rav Moshe reiterates. What is the whole purpose? Why does the church want to have this dialogue? Asher Kavanaso, hu lahavir kola yehudim emunasam chas v'shalom. The whole purpose is to convert us. And all of this is, right, the cardinals and the pope, they all have this whole strategy with the priests. They're going to come, they're going to get to us, they're going to have committees, you see in parentheses, committees, the next parentheses, conventions. The whole purpose is to try to convert us, and they've been successful, but hitzliach maisa satan, sheneschabru lezeh ezer rabbanim b'horas heter. Who gave the horas heter? Who told them it was okay? The rav, I guess. Or other rabbanim who told them it's okay to participate in these conventions, these committees. What? Shelo yidabru b'inyane emuna, elib inyane chevra. Again, the same distinction. Because after all, what are the rabbis telling Rav Moshe? We're not going to talk about religion and theology. We're just going to discuss social issues. And Rav Moshe was against that as well. Why? Again, it's important to know the why. Shakal kabarasam hurak lavoye dezel inyan emuna. They're using this as a strategy. They want to seduce us. It doesn't matter. Afla dvarim ba'alma. It's usher. Hakol shekein. Because this is coming. Shizeg ba me'etza. Harisha shal rosh hakomrim. That's the Pope. The head of the priest, the Pope, it's coming from him, it's usher. What is it going to lead to? Kibao l'shivui emuna v'deos u'lispal yachem. It's going to come to somehow joining or a relativistic equating of the religions. They're even going to pray together. It's so terrible. So what does he want? Why is he telling this to the Rav? Because he wants the Rav and him, they should, two of them should sign a joint letter. This is his request. He wants the two of them should sign a joint letter prohibiting rabbis from being participants in all these types of conferences. This is what he says here in the last few lines. If everyone will come together and we'll do this.
He says that one of your students came to.
Yes, right. One second. I just wonder where's the part here. If you look four lines down from the bottom of that column, in order that we can somehow undo all this terrible thing, what should happen now? What is my desire? Shigam, you, this great gon, yachtom, you'll sign with me. I'm sending you the letter. She'isr gomer, we should sign a proclamation. That's usr lihischaber and makomrim. We shouldn't get together with the priest. We shum ofen for anything. And again, he reiterates, af lo ledvarim ba'alma, not even for social or moral things, in addition to obviously religious things. Lo lishtatev, so she but Boston. Apparently there was some conference planned for Boston. There shouldn't be that. Not in anything here, not in America, not in Europe. There shouldn't be at all. Umekaveh ani, says Rav Moshe, that I hope, shepsakdin shel shneinu. Again, these are great people and fundamentally very humble. They're also self-aware. And Moshe knew that the two most important Rashivas in the world, certainly in America, I should say, were him and Soloveitchik. So he says, I hope that because of our influence, that the two of us will sign this, ani mekaveh ani shepsak din shel shneinu, yimne lekol harabanim mizeh, v'tofer atzas rishayim, etc., etc., right? So all the people who look to me for guidance, they won't go because I signed it. All the people who look to you for guidance won't go because you signed it. Hopefully this will all take place and everything will get better. Now what's significant, again, I won't read the Nusach HaIsra, which you have below. I underlined some of the key parts. But again, it's really a reiteration of everything we've seen in the previous two tshuvos. Again, Rav Moshe's thesis is that their whole motivation is for mass conversion. They want to try to get us. They couldn't get us yet. They want to get us now. And the therefore is, it's all usher, not just theological dialogue, but even social, political, moral discussions. It's all off the table because even then they're all trying, it's all a hook, it's a bait and switch, they all want to get us. So, if you look, I'll go back to an important chronological point in a second, but if you look at the English article beneath it, it comes from David Ellison. Who knows, familiar with the name David Ellison? He's the current director of HUC. I'm not exactly sure of his background. I'm not sure if he was raised Orthodox or not, but he definitely has a very traditional background. Very traditional background, which is reflected in two things. One is his scholarship, and one is a general feeling he's much more warmer and less confrontational than some of his other colleagues are to Orthodoxy. And he's a shtickle scholar.
What is HUC?
Hebrew Union College, the Reformed Medical Seminary, in my hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. So he has a book called After the Emancipation, a lot of very interesting articles and material in this book. And in chapter 17, the whole chapter 17 is about the two tshuvas of Rav Moshe and his take on the differences between Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe. The first paragraph you see over there on the left is a summary of the Rav's approach. On page 400 on the bottom here, he summarizes again Rav Moshe's approach. And if you look on the right side, he summarizes again in reading the Feinstein response that it is clear that he viewed the relationship between Jews and Christians as unaltered by the modern developments such as Vatican II. He could perceive no Christian motive for initiating joint religious dialogue other than the conversion of Jews. All in all, a pretty accurate summary of Rav Moshe's opinion. Then he goes on page 404, and he makes a whole binyan, a whole bama, about the differences between approaches of Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe, and he analyzes it in the following way. After talking about the Rav's general worldview, he says, as a result, Soloveitchik did not respond to Feinstein's overture in the refusal to condemn this Jewish-Christian dialogue in its harsh and overarching terms, nor would he reverse a position in confrontation. This is no indication that Soloveitchik signed the declaration or that he appended his letter. There's no record that Soloveitchik offered an alternative letter. There's any record that Soloveitchik offered formulations. If he had agreed to do either, we would have had a record of it, etc., etc. These are the two most formative leaders, etc., etc. So my only comment on this whole page, as we move forward, is two things. Number one, he has this whole idea. Again, I didn't give you all of it, but I gave you the reference if you want to go pick up the book yourself. His basic thesis, which I alluded to here in the part that I read for you, is that only Rav Moshe was worried about the conversion issue, about the Shemad issue. Now, you could argue with some of his reading in the sense that a discerning reader can see that that's not 100% true, even in essay itself. But certainly, we have much anecdotal and historical evidence from people who talked to the Rav, whether it was his daughter, Mrs. Torsky, who I've spoken to indirectly about this, or what we saw last week in the source book that I prepared, from Rav Lichtenstein, from Dr. Bernard Rosenzweig, and others, Rabbi Wurzburger, his closest students and relatives who worked with him, who in every one of their presentations told us that one of the main fears that the Rav had was the same conversion issue. You'll ask, why did he say it explicitly? So we mentioned last week, there's a big difference between writing a Hebrew tshuva in Igros Moshe and a letter to Rav Soloveitchik, and writing an English essay, which, as we said last week, was read the world over and continues to be read, not just by Jews, but by plenty of non-Jews. And as I said, I don't know if the Pope himself read it, but certainly his highest lieutenants were reading that essay, and they know about it. So he had to deal with much more diplomacy than Rav Moshe did. But it's not at all clear that on that point there was any debate. So does that mean that they totally agreed? So here's another point which is worth noting, which I go back to the dates. If you look at the end, I glossed over it too quickly, but if you look at the end of the Rav Moshe's letter to Rav Soloveitchik, he references the fact that I know that you're involved in many things, many tirdos, and the last two words of the letter are he has hope for refuah shalema. So if you know the dates of 1967, you know Adar Sheni, what you may know is that 4 days after this letter arrived, the Rav's wife died. She was already deathly ill. It was not a sudden death. Rav Moshe is aware that the Rav is distracted. So two Fridays ago, when I called the Rav's grandson, Rabbi Meir Torsky, who spoke to him about an hour about these topics, so one of the points he mentioned to me when I asked him about the differences in opinion between the Rav and the letter, etc., and again, I didn't tell him about Ellenson per se, but I said, you know, a lot of people are making a big deal that there's different approaches, the Rav and the Rav Moshe Feinstein. So he said, one thing I'll tell you, because unless this letter, and again, this Ellenson makes a big deal, the Rav didn't sign the letter, we have no record of him signing the letter, etc. He says, one thing I'll tell you, unless that letter was hand-delivered, which I'm assuming it was not, there is no chance the Rav ever saw the letter. He says, after his mother died, his grandmother died, he says, there were stacks of mail from weeks before she died that were never opened. Again, you can imagine, his wife was dying. As important as this was, it wasn't as important as his wife and his wife's sickness. So he's convinced that the Rav never saw the letter. Now, does that mean that he didn't know that Rav Moshe disagreed or had this opinion? It's hard to imagine. You know, they probably saw each other at a wedding a year later. I mean, they were relatives and they were friends. It's hard to imagine. But he felt that you should not make too big a deal out of Rav not signing the letter. You have to realize the context. Bottom line, does that mean they didn't disagree at all? So I think that's not true. I think there's no question that there was some level of disagreement. It's no question that Rav Moshe felt, because of the assumptions that he made, which the Rav may have agreed with, that therefore everything was off the table. And it's clear that even though apparently the Rav had agreed with some of the fears, he did not necessarily think that everything should be off the table. If you turn the page over, you will see in an article which we will come back to, from what I hope will be now, and certainly by the end of tonight, a familiar personality, that is the great one, Dr. David Berger. So he has, we saw last week, a number of comments from him from that Boston College symposium. But he also wrote in the September of 2001, you see the date, that's 6 days after September 11th. He wrote in a magazine called America. And we spoke last week about First Things. Anyone get America here? That's the weekly Catholic magazine. No, one guesses that?
The weekly what?
Catholic magazine. It's called America.
Yeah.
I gave you a preview of First Things. This is not a last week, which is a Catholic intellectual journal. This is not a preview, but this came out a few years ago. So David Berger wrote an article there, and if you look at this point where he's talking about the Rav's opinions, he mentions specifically what we have Baruch Shekivanu. We have analyzed it and come to the same conclusion, which is that the Rav, even though, and Berger reiterates it again here, the Rav did have fears about the missionizing. And that was one of his motivations, even though he didn't put it explicitly into the text. Nevertheless, he felt that the social moral discussions were permissible or even a valuable thing to help the world, so to speak. Even though he knew, again, that in theory, those discussions could lead to problems. So on that particular point, again, I'm not here to analyze who was right, who was wrong, what makes more sense. But it's probably true if you put everything together, the anecdotal evidence, the written evidence, this article, others, that the debate between a Rav and a Moshe was probably not as great as is sometimes perceived, but it's probably fair to say that on that specific point, there probably was a difference of opinion, and Zuma Chamta Shel Torah, two great, great leaders, had a different opinion on a very complicated and difficult issue, not entirely surprising. Let's move now to some more recent developments, and I want to set the stage for some of the more recent, and not only recent, but actually local. Baltimore is actually the heart of everything that goes on. Some local issues, and I want to set the transition for that by reflecting back on something which we saw in the first week. If you remember in the first week, the first source packet that we studied together, at the end of this big conference in the RCA convention in February of 1964, the Rav is given this big keynote address. So now the RCA is a group, they have a conference. What does the conference have to do? They make a statement. So at the end of the conference, they made a statement, which was appended and added to the original article and tradition in 1964, the RCA statement about basically endorsing, if you will, their leader, the Rav's, Soloveitchik's approach. And in there, we read that all in its entirety the first week, but just to review, you'll see this particular point here, just because I think this sets a good transition for us. They speak about here the current threat of secularism and materialism, the modern atheistic negation of religion and religious values, make even more imperative a harmonious relationship among the faiths. Okay, this is akin to something I told you, the professor at Yale Law School, I'm so fond of, Stephen Carter, who made, I think, maybe he reads tradition, but he made the very sharp comment that in today's day and age, members of all faiths are members of the same minority religion, the people of faith. So this is basically what the RCA was saying in 1964. And given that, we should have a relationship, but the relationship can only be if it will not be in conflict with the uniqueness of each religious community, since each religious community is an individual entity which cannot be merged, equated with a community which is committed to a different faith, etc., etc. In other words, what is he saying? What are the RCA saying then? What this cannot involve is a blurring of the lines about what we believe and what you believe about trying to make us all come to some common ground. If that's going to be what happens, either directly or as a result, we're not interested in that, even if it means not being a part of something which you would otherwise want to be a part of. If you look to the left, you'll see from Dr. Berger once again in that same America article, where he again, this is only from a few years ago, he reiterates in his beautiful language very sharply this same fear. For Jews to the context here is, again, remember we all learned a word together, it was called supersessionism. Supersession is the belief that Jews were originally the chosen people, and now the Catholics, the Christians, supersede us. And one of the big issues of Vatican II, which they were reevaluating, not all Christians, but at least the Catholic Church, is that they, to some extent, were backing off of that belief. And that was very significant, and we'll see its impact on Jews as we continue now. But one of the issues was, that the Rav said, is, what's this idea? The Jews, we were being invited to Rome, we should be looking over their shoulder, right? If they make a statement, we're going to be standing up, we veto it, we have a problem with it. So the Rav was against all of that. And he says the following, he says, for Jews to denounce this sort of supersessionism as morally wrong, right? We're going to get offended. Who are you to tell us? And we're all very offended. They think they're the chosen people, we're the chosen people. So he says, for us to be offended and be telling them this, is morally wrong and disqualifying in the context of dialogue is to turn dialogue into a novel form of religious intimidation. Who are we to tell them? We believe what we believe, but we shouldn't be intimidating them and telling them what's right or wrong about what their beliefs are. As a preeminent Orthodox rabbinical authority, I've addressed Rabbi Soloveitchik, understood very well, such a position is pragmatically dangerous for Jews who become vulnerable to reciprocal demands for theological reform of Judaism, and it is even morally wrong. I want to focus now in this section on the practical issue. I want to demonstrate it with some very recent events, as I say, coming out of Baltimore. But the issue, just to be clear, is there was this fear, namely, of reciprocity. They're going to reevaluate, they're going to adjust, they're going to reformulate in a more sensitive way. And again, it's human nature to expect some form of reciprocity. So we're going to encourage you and we're going to be cheering, yay, it's great that you're saying such nice things about us. But what happens when they turn to us and they say, to take a very minor example, maybe you should censor out of all new Talmuds page X and X, which doesn't say such nice things about us. Maybe you should reformulate one of Maimonides' 13 principles, which seems to preclude belief in the Trinity. After all, look how much we've done for you. We're taking a step. We've reached out. I don't know that I would have been aware of that fear at the time. I could easily imagine being so caught up in the 60s and the excitement. Can you imagine the Catholic Church was 20 years after the Holocaust and they're reevaluating anti-Semitism, their view of the Jews? But yeah, it was part of his genius to be foresighted enough to realize that the more we, again, that it happens goes into hate, but the more we embrace and are involved in that, the more they're going to have a tie to us, which is they're going to have a claim on us to reciprocate. And this is a major fear. If you look to the right, again, I have from Dr. Berger, this goes back to the Boston College Symposium of last November, which we spent a lot of time last week discussing. Here Dr. Berger says again very sharply, Rabbi Soloveitchik worried that theological dialogue would create pressure to trade favors pertaining to fundamental matters of faith, to reconcile some differences, quote-unquote. He argued against any Jewish interference in the faith of Christians, both on the grounds of principle, which again is not our issue now, and out of concern that it would create a framework for reciprocal expectations. Now, the changes in Catholic attitudes detailed, again, for those who were here last week, you remember Dr. Korn and all the things he was talking about, how the church has done so nice to us. They're real, they're welcome, they're significant, but they do not undermine these concerns. Quite the contrary. The trajectory of dialogue to our own day has confirmed the validity of Rabbi Soloveitchik's analysis to an almost stunning degree. I now want, with that introduction, again, we saw the 60s and we're setting the table for the 90s and beyond, to set the stage for something that happened in the year 2000. It has, again, I wouldn't call it mass audience, but it has worldwide audience, and it all comes from the city of Baltimore. Many of you may be familiar with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies here in Baltimore. Yes?
Just before you get to that,
yes.
The last line, does that indicate that there have been overtures by the Catholic Church that we should change some of our...
Yes. And we're going to talk about it now. Thank you. So there is this institute in Baltimore. I only nominally heard of it before I moved here, but before I moved here, I did not know that they're from Baltimore. But that was, I was a lesser person for that. So if you look, before we see exactly what they have done in recent years and what's so controversial about it, to set the stage, I want to turn your attention to an article in the December 2001 issue of the journal or the magazine Commentary, which I assume if you don't all regularly read, you're probably all regularly familiar with. The journal Commentary, again, I spent so much time discussing Catholic journals and magazines, I should a little bit get back to Am Yisrael. Commentary. So in this, a professor at Harvard, who I don't know exactly his background, but I'm pretty sure he's Jewish but not Orthodox, is a brilliant, brilliant professor named John Levinson. We're going to be seeing a lot of an article that he wrote. Very sharp title, How Not to Conduct Jewish-Christian Dialogue. This comes from December 2001. But I want to give you, before we see the specifics, just an opening paragraph that he starts with. Because until now we've been discussing what I hope has been interesting and informative, but a lot of it has been in the luft. A lot of it is theoretical. But he points out that that's exactly what the Catholics tie into us. He says, here again, he reviews a little bit of the Christian changes in theology, and he says, how has this change in Christian attitudes been greeted by the Jews? So as a political or cultural matter, of course, we're happy, wonderful. Why shouldn't we be happy that they're evaluating these things? But what has been slower in coming, Ron, and what many Christians, after painful reevaluation of their own tradition, have been most eager to receive, is a considered historical and theological response. Now that they've, you know, reevaluated anti-Semitism, etc., will Jews acknowledge that the two communities are members of the same larger spiritual grouping? Do they, or do we view Christians as just no different vis-a-vis us? As he says, Hindus or Buddhists, which are obviously maybe nice people, but everyone understands that's a very distant religion and tradition from ours. So how do we view Christianity? Christians want to know. How do you guys think about us? Are we just another religion you don't believe in? Or are we part of some one larger faith community? Now, why are they asking us this? Because of all that they've done to move towards us in their view, they want to know, Sanu, where do you think about us? So there have been many examples that I could cite in which, either publicly, privately, large or small, in which individuals or organizations of Jews have made certain overtures in return. Perhaps the most significant came from the year 2000. And there was a whole group of Jewish scholars that was associated and assembled by this institute here in Baltimore. Eventually they had four Jewish academicians, each one very well-known scholars in universities, one in Toronto, the other three in America, who got together, who wrote this new statement of principles, which they entitled Dabru Emet, which is Statement of Truth. Now, I first knew about Dabru Emet because they didn't just publish this on a website or send out a flyer to somebody. They took out, and among other places, a full-page ad in the New York Times, where this was published, along with the well over 100 Jewish rabbis and academic scholars who signed and affirmed this statement. So there are, each one of these principles, which I have here for you, have subparagraphs, which are marich a little bit, but there's only so much I can fit on 6 pages of notes. So I deleted that, but I did give you the website if you want to go learn more about the Institute or even see more detail these principles. But basically, the principles that they signed were the following. And we will be analyzing some of these in a few moments. Jews and Christians worship the same God. Jews and Christians seek authority from the same book, the Bible. Christians can respect the claim of the Jewish people upon the land of Israel. Jews and Christians accept the moral principles of the Torah. Nazism was not a Christian phenomenon. The humanly irreconcilable differences between Jews and Christians will not be settled until God redeems the entire world, as promised in Scripture. A new relationship between Jews and Christians will not weaken Jewish practice. And finally, Jews and Christians must work together for justice and peace. So I'll let you take a moment to just absorb these so that you can form even a preliminary opinion if you think these are good things or bad, or perhaps most importantly, if they're true or not. So as I said, there was many people, many Jewish leaders and rabbis, including some local ones, who signed this. What you'll notice if you look at the list, and the list is also available online, is a paucity of Orthodox signatories, including the absence, and we'll see in a moment when we turn the page, a very significant absence, of some within the Orthodox community who generally are very involved.
Yitz Greenberg.
I don't remember if he signed it, but if I had to guess, I would guess he did. But I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But we'll see in a moment somebody as significant as Michael Wishergrad, who we saw last week, very brilliant professor from Guy, who wrote Black on White, we studied last week, that the Rav was wrong in confrontation, and therefore we should be involved in interreligious dialogue. He, as a matter of principle, and we'll see in a few moments why, refused to sign this. The point is there were a few Orthodox people who did sign it, but it was a small number. And the question, of course, is why? And I think that the answer very much goes to where this ran afoul for many of the things that we've been developing the last 2 weeks. So if you look at the bottom of the page again from Dr. Berger, he references, again, this was from something that he spoke about at this Boston College Symposium last November, but he refers back to this issue of Dabru Emet from the year 2000. As I noted in a paper on Dabru Emet posted on the center's website, he tells a story. He tells two stories here. Stories are good. So Dr. Berger, great, brilliant historian, he even tells stories. He tells two good stories here. So he tells of one of the participants in dialogue, who in general, and again, he doesn't tell us his name, but Dr. Berger attests to us that this particular Christian has as positive an attitude towards Jews as one could hope for, and when he was congratulating the Jewish theologians who authored the Dabru Emet, his congratulations said the following: the dialogue will be stymied if Christians affirm a theological bonding with Jews without an acknowledgement of such bonding from the Jewish side. Everything the Rav feared in the 60s comes to fruition. They're making all these moves for 30, 40 years They want someone else to put out their hand and take it. If we're making all these moves, you got to make moves. And therefore, he was giving a grace yishakayach to Dabru Emet for making this great move. He then tells another story. There's a whole story how the New York Board of Rabbis, which is similar to the Baltimore Board of Rabbis here. In Baltimore, it's an interdenominational Jewish group of rabbis, had a whole joint prayer service in New York in a church. So Dr. Berger published a letter in which he was very critical of the New York Board of Rabbis, and he made reference in that letter to the fact that you're taking Jews to a place of Avodah Zarah to worship. So this caused a big scandal in New York, and the New York Archdiocese, I mean not little guys, the Archdiocese of New York, including a very senior leader there, specifically publicly criticized Dr. Berger, and he mentions how a particular senior member privately sent him a letter, it was very critical. Dr. Berger realized that perhaps in that contact, that word wasn't the most sensitive to use, etc., etc. But after all is said and done, and this is a significant part for us, one of the things that in this private letter he criticized Berger for, the stuff in the Archdiocese, is, if you look in the middle of that right-hand paragraph, in a private letter to me, he complained about my expressing such an assessment of Christianity. Here's the critical point. After all that Catholics have done to reassess their negative image of Judaism. In other words, it's not just, they're not just upset that you would think that we're Avodah Zarah. How could you think that after all that we've done for you? So what does Dr. Berger conclude? Last line. Rabbi Soloveitchik's concern about the trading of favors pertaining to fundamental matters of faith could not be more clearly illustrated. Again, the issue for us is not whether Dr. Berger should have wrote the letter, published it, used the word Avodah Zarah, not used the word Avodah Zarah. The point is, if all of a sudden Jewish leaders have to feel constrained by what they say and what they do because of what the Catholic Church is doing for us, then that creates a major problem on our own independence. If you look here on the next page, I have for you, again, it was a very long article in Commentary Magazine, but I picked four of my favorite snippets from, again, this fellow, John Levinson, is a professor at Harvard. He wrote this very damning article against Dabru Emet. Again, it was entitled How Not to Do, Conduct Jewish Christian Dialogue. The whole essay is a criticism of Dabru Emet. We'll see, continuing all the letters in the next issue, many of it were people who had signed it, criticizing him and defending it. But let's look at some of the points that he makes. And again, there are many of them. I don't want to get into some specific ones. I gave you the reference. Commentaries available online. Although it happens to be one of the journals or magazines in which it's not available for free. You have to pay like $3 or something if you want a back article. But if you're really interested, I recommend it. I'm going to be rushing through it just for the sake of time. But you'll see that not only are some of his ideas beautiful, his writing is beautiful. It's just a pleasure to read somebody like this. He's really, again, I don't know anything else about him, but he's obviously a very, very brilliant fellow. So he starts the article, let's get right into it. Dabru Emet suffers from the great pitfalls of interfaith dialogue as it has come to be practiced over the past several decades. After all, the Christians have done so much for us, and therefore it is inevitable and tempting in such exercises to avoid any candid discussion of fundamental beliefs, to adopt instead the model of conflict resolution or diplomatic negotiation. The goal is to reach an agreement. Not whatever the issues were that brought you to the table. The goal is the agreement. Commonalities are stressed and differences. Again, this is just a beautiful sentence. Commonalities are stressed and the differences, the reason presumably for entering into dialogue in the first place, are minimized, neglected, or denied altogether. Once this model is adopted, the ultimate objective becomes not just agreement, but mutual affirmation. The critical judgments that the religious traditions have historically made upon each other are increasingly presented as merely the tragic fruit of prejudice and misunderstanding. And what was the famous saying of 10 years ago or so? Why can't we all just get along? Nebuch, Jews died at the stake. It was just misunderstanding. They didn't realize how similar Christianity was to Judaism. Yeah, he's not an Orthodox man. This is his critique in the general sense of this Dabru Emet enterprise. So then he gets more specific. You look on page 34. In recent years, Christians have made these ideas the basis for a positive evaluation of Judaism. Again, he's referring to the ideas that in certain circles, they've been hosed around this idea of supersessionism. Namely, that maybe Judaism, all Jews are not meant to convert, at least not before Achras Hayamim. When it comes to the second coming, so then of course they assume that Judaism will dissolve. But the question is, what should we be doing now? Historically, of course, the assumption was that there's no salvation without accepting Christ, etc., etc. And again, within certain circles of the Catholic Church, not so clear that it's beyond the Church, but even within certain circles of that Church, some people have reevaluated and chosen a little bit on that belief. So because they've reevaluated such a significant belief, that's why they are coming to us expecting significant reciprocity. And it is understandable that the authors of Dabru Emet should feel the need, again, here's that word again, to reciprocate. But there's one little problem, says Levinson. The relationship is not symmetrical. For classical Judaism, there is no covenant between God and the church. No parallel, that is, to Paul's belief in the irrevocable call of the Israelite patriarchs. In other words, whatever their issues are with us, they've always believed that we were the original chosen nation. And therefore, whatever they believe should be happening to us now, there's a basis to at least see our religion, not just us as people, but our religion in a positive light. There is no parallel in Jewish thought. It's not like we believe that it was this relationship with the church, but now it's with us. So that makes things very, very difficult. He's therefore very critical, and therefore, even though in the longer pieces, the Davar HaEmet people speak in very positive ways about Christianity, even for non-Jews, so Levinson says such an idea is contrived for the purposes of dialogue without any real foundation in Jewish thought. It only moves to slightly more secure ground when in another of its theses it asserts Jews and Christians accept the same the moral principles of the Torah. How many Christians ask themselves, are my morals in line with the Torah? They are more likely to ask, what would Jesus do? Hence the WWJD on bumper stickers and t-shirts. So we're blurring, says Levinson, it's just not true. Page 35. Maybe there are some overtures or common areas of common ground. Davar HaEmet is not wrong to draw attention to common scripture and similar lessons. The problem is that it reduces what is not common to mere differences of opinion, as if the two traditions make no truth claims. This easygoing relativism profoundly impedes any sophisticated understanding, etc., etc. A more accurate statement would note that it is precisely the points of commonality that make disputation over the differences inevitable, at least within communities committed to the idea of religious truth, and not simply to the theological equivalent of, I'm okay, you're okay. So we're blurring the lines all for the sake of agreement. They've done so much for us, we feel the need to reciprocate, so how do we do that? We blur Jewish history, we blur Jewish thought, and we basically engage in religious relativism where there is no more sense of truth. And in my favorite group of paragraphs, turn to page 37, and he says the following. For the thrust of this statement is to make the two communities look as alike, as two peas in a single religious pod. Both are told they pray to the same God, appeal to the same book, apply to the same principles, etc., etc. And even Nazism would have turned, this is one of their statements, that Nazism would have turned this murderous rage towards Christians if it hadn't been stopped. So the only difference is we were on the first train, they would have been on the second train, he has that line. Very, very sharp critique. It's all the same. And then here he says so beautifully, although the statement mentions disagreements and asks that they be respected, it is hard to come away from it without feeling that the nearly 2,000 years of Jewish-Christian disputation were based on a little more than the narcissism of small differences. Why was there the disputation in Barcelona? No, people overreacted. They didn't realize how much we have in common. What did the Rambam need to write his Yigaras HaShemad for? Come on, can't we all get along? There's really not that many differences. Again, this is Levinson's critique of Davar HaEmet, that that's the message that it's sending. If, as we are told, the commonalities between the two religions really are so basic and so all-encompassing, and now he gets to a very practical criticism, why indeed should intermarriage, or for that matter, conversion to Christianity be resisted so strenuously as the tradition has long enjoined Jews from doing? None of this need deter anyone from speaking the truth, again, that's what Davar HaEmet means, by the relationship between Jews and Christians as he sees it. But for the authors and signatories of Davar HaEmet to assert that their version of this truth poses no hazards to Jewish practice and identity is not just wishful thinking, it is whistling in the dark. So his final nail in the coffin is, and furthermore, by creating all this blur and relativist cholent, you're actually creating more problems and threats of assimilation. Why should Jews be so standoffish to converting to another religion when really they wouldn't be making such a big jump? Ad kan divrei hagoyin, Dr. Levinson. So the next, one of the next issues in April 2002 has about 25 pages of letters. Supporters of Davar HaEmet and therefore critics of Levinson. Supporters of Levinson and critics of Davar HaEmet. So there are many supporters of Davar HaEmet. For the sake of hometown nostalgia, and I believe there are some friends perhaps even in the room and certainly in Shomrei, I included one of the letters there from Charles Arian from the Jewish Institute of Jewish Christian Studies at Baltimore, Maryland. So the point that he makes is interesting. He is involved with his institute. He actually, in his letter, never addresses any of the substance in the first 90% of the article of Levinson. But he does strenuously disagree with the last point of Levinson. How can you claim that because of all this that we're doing, we're increasing intermarriage possibilities or assimilation? As he says here, bottom of the first paragraph, Jews are intermarrying not because they no longer feel repugnance for Christianity, but because they have ceased to believe in and practice in Judaism. Many Jews make no religious affirmation beyond the view that Jesus was not the Messiah. A religious identity based on nothing more than the negation of the other has no staying power. Now, I largely, not totally, but largely agree with Arian. But I want to save that, because we're going to get back to that issue in a few moments. If you turn over the page, you have, going from left to right, three letters that were incredibly critical of Dabur Emet, and therefore very supportive of Professor Levinson. But I want to start with the one all the way on the left, from Professor Jacob Neusner. Now, Jacob Neusner, first of all, for Shomrei now has one significant relationship. He's Avua de Noam. His son is Noam Neusner, who came to the Shomrei dinner this year on June 13th, bringing greetings to me from the president. That's Jacob Neusner. That's his son, Noam Neusner, the fellow who's now the director of Jewish relations for the White House. He is a very prolific writer and a longtime scholar, and he has been affiliated, I think, formally with the conservative movement. So he writes, not only does he agree with Levinson, he takes the gloves off. And he very much disagrees with Arian. He is devastating in his critique. He says the following. What Levinson only mentions at the end, in his last 10%, that there's this whole practical issue of intermarriage and assimilation. For him, says Neusner, that's the ikker. Says, it seems to me that the statement's urgency derives from the practical politics of finding something to say on the subjects of Hanukkah and Christmas, and Easter and Passover, not to mention the problems of little Moshe O'Reilly. With more than half the Reform congregations in the country unwilling to hire clergy who do not perform intermarriage, with conservative rabbis facing heavy pressure not to preach against intermarriage at all, Dabur Emet is more than politically expedient. The statement's utter misrepresentation of Judaism's view of Christianity, which Mr. Levinson puts on display, is a necessary theological cover for the shame of Reform and conservative Judaism and their rabbis' craven politics. Ouch. But then he lets us have it. What motivated the handful of Orthodox signers, I cannot imagine. So, this is a machlekes between Neusner and Arian. How much does such a statement or such involvement relate to issues which, we have to be honest, do not totally unaffect the Orthodox community, but obviously more significantly relate to the non-Orthodox community? Again, it's obviously significant. There you have a very leading non-Orthodox scholar being very, very critical of people from his own background, his own world, and he directly thinks that this is all cover. Now, I'm not sure I agree with him, but it's interesting to know that there is that debate out there. Now let's turn to the final two letters. Again, there's 25 letters, but two Orthodox letters, and they're significant not only because the people who wrote them are of significant scholarship, because they're both people who actually really, really know and have been involved in interreligious or Jewish-Christian dialogue. The first one, which is the middle column, the second column, is from Michael Wishergard. Again, to remind you, again, he's a brilliant scholar, very big philosopher, and he's the one who we saw last week who wrote a whole critique why he thought Soloveitchik was wrong in confrontation. And therefore, he has been, and he says you should be, very involved in dialogue. If I'm not mistaken, he was early on involved in the formulation of Dabur Emet. Again, here you have this brilliant Orthodox philosopher who's been involved with the ADL and other places in dialogue. You'd imagine he'd be involved in this. But he bowed out at some point in the middle and, in fact, never signed it. So he writes in, John Levinson's cogent critique of Dabur Emet as a service to Jews and Christians who could easily be misled into concluding that there are no really difficult theological differences between their faiths. Goes on and on. As last paragraph, as an Orthodox Jew who has devoted much energy to Jewish-Christian dialogue, I am saddened that Dabur Emet missed the opportunity to produce a document that did not evade the hard questions while contributing to improving Jewish-Christian relations. Now, what he didn't say, I don't know what he said to himself, but what he certainly didn't say publicly was, I was wrong and the Rav was right. I don't know if he said it to himself or not, but it's certainly clear to me that that should be his reaction. Again, one of the major fears was always that this was inevitable, that the more you dance with them, it's only natural. It's not unmenschlich of them. When they write a letter to Dr. Berger, after all we've done for you, what are you going to do for us? I understand that completely. That's totally understandable. You can't blame them if we've been cheering them on actively, if not passively, but actively sometimes and involved. Change, change, change. So of course you have to expect. You can't put on the brakes just when you want to. So the Rav knew that. That's why he said don't get involved to begin with. Finally, just to give you the last part of it, once again, he has been the star of the show, Dr. Bergen. So he wrote in the letter, and what's significant, the reason I want to share this letter is because he actually then reproduces, which I could have gotten from another source, but it was easier for me to get it from here. He actually ended up being when the OU and the RCA wanted to have a statement. Officially, unofficially, right? None of their members virtually signed this Dabru Emet. What were they thinking? They turned to none other than Dr. David Berger to write the statement on behalf of the OU and the RCA, and he actually reproduces that statement. And he says the following. Dabru Emet is in many ways an admirable statement composed by people whom I have high regard. I agree with much of it, including its controversial but carefully balanced passage denying Nazism was a Christian phenomenon. However, I did not agree to sign it for several reasons. First, for all of its exquisitely skillful formulation, it implies that Jews should reassess their view of Christianity in light of Christian reassessments of Judaism. This inclination towards theological reciprocity is fraught with danger. Now, he's being very makatzer here, but we know from all the articles we've read from him ahead of time why he thinks that, where it comes from, with Soloveitchik, and all of the elaboration he's done. Second, although it is proper to emphasize that Christians worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, etc., etc., it is essential to add that they also worship Jesus of Nazareth as a manifestation or component of that God, and that such a belief constitutes what Jewish law and theology call avodah zarah, at least if done by a Jew. What he's alluding to here, which we're not going to discuss tonight, is a very complicated machlokas in the Rishonim. What is the status of Christianity? Many Rishonim think that it is avodah zarah, idolatry for Jew, for non-Jew, for everybody. But there is a middle position in Rishonim, which he is alluding to, which makes the following distinction, that for a Jew to worship Christianity, that would be a violation of avodah zarah, because of what our standards of theology are. But for a non-Jew to worship Christianity, perhaps that is not avodah zarah. So our Rishonim will take that position, and that is what he was alluding to here. But the point is that none of that's mentioned. Jesus doesn't get into Dabru Emet. You have a theological statement about Jews and Christians without mentioning Jesus. Who are you kidding? Basically, that's his point. And finally, the statement discourages either community for insisting that it is interpreted scripture more accurately than the other. While intended for the laudable purpose of discouraging missionizing, this assertion conveys an uncomfortably relativistic message. Again, going back to Levinson's point. The whole premise of this enterprise seemed to be, I'm okay, you're okay, there's no real truth. Obviously, that has to be something that is rejected. Any questions?
I mean, the Christians are coming to us. Is there any way that they're trying to be forgiven? Is there anything that... To me, it seems like they're asking for forgiveness from us for what they want, have done.
Well, the last part of this speech, which we're very closely getting to, don't want anyone to get nervous. We'll get to it later. Later could be in a few minutes.
Which is important.
We're going to discuss... We're going to see mentioned the idea of their looking for atonement over the Holocaust. We're going to get to that.
Maybe over the other things as well.
Okay, perhaps. Yes.
Where exactly is the implication of reciprocity in the
Again, I gave you just seven, the actual things. But it's not, again, it's not that they're implying reciprocity. The whole existence of it is an expression of reciprocity. In other words, here the Christians have been reevaluating, talking about all the common things and why Jesus is not so bad. And now here Dabru Emet is reciprocating that by telling them, you're not so bad, you're not so different than us, we're really so similar. And that's the critique. To me, it's evident even from these seven or eight principles. But again, if you're interested in seeing them more in detail, if you go to the website, you'll see again, under each one of those headings, are a paragraph elaborating on it. And again, the basic premise, which is what Levinson was talking about, and Dr. Berg and everyone, was this idea that here we are, we're reevaluating things, which again, as Levinson said, there are statements there that are made, which is, to quote Levinson, have no basis at all in Jewish tradition, and the only logical explanation for why they would be doing this, again, the professors who wrote this, not Orthodox, but very learned and scholarly, is because, again, the theory goes, because they feel the need to compromise on certain things so that they can make an accommodating reciprocal statement to the Christians. I want to move on now just so that we can finish, and I want to transition now before we do that, I'll just point your attention to, I'm not going to read it, but in 2003 there was an article in the magazine, in the newspaper The Forward, by my friend and former Chavrusa, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, Aaron Soloveitchik's grandson. And he wrote a title, actually the title was given to him, How Soloveitchik Saw Interreligious Dialogue. It was the 10th Yahrzeit of his great uncle, and he decided to write a piece which was published in the newspaper about it. And he makes the point, many of the points that we've just made, and he makes the point how, in general, the reason that most Orthodox Jew rabbis have stayed away were based on issues of the Rav, and then he specifically references Dabru Emet, and how it was a violation of what the Rav was worried about, or a confirmation of all the Rav's worst fears. So this is just another example of where this got played out. I want to move now to something which is really unrelated, but on some level related, and that is to contemporary politics. Politics, as we'll see in a few moments, in terms of issues, as I alluded to in my previews of this series, in terms of the most recent election, issues that brought up with the religious right in the Jewish community. But even before that, I wanted to get into the whole issue of religious fundamentalism and the fact that that is a major issue in the world, especially with regard, obviously, to everything going on in the Middle East, in particular with what seems to be some level of war between radical Islam and the Western world. So shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks in November, of the end of November of that month, Thomas Friedman, who was a name I'm sure you're all familiar with, even if you don't subscribe to the New York Times, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. I think twice a week he writes an op-ed page on the most prestigious op-ed page in the world, the New York Times. And he's won a Pulitzer Prize. And his particular area where he writes 90% of his Torah is about the Middle East. And he's had many, many different theories. So in November, right after this, he writes a piece. Again, this I got online, so it doesn't have the Tzuras Hadaf. The New York Times, Hakadosha. This is from the New York Times. The title of his piece that day was The Real Work. And I don't have page A, whatever the left page. He's always on the right side of that fold. He's always much to the bottom right. That's where he is. The title of his piece was The Real War. If 9/11 was indeed the onset of World War III, we have to understand what this war is about. We are not fighting to eradicate terrorism. Terrorism is just a tool. We are fighting to defeat an ideology, religious totalitarianism. What is this? What is this belief? It's a view that of the world that my faith must reign supreme and can be affirmed and held passionately only if all others are negated. That's bin Ladenism. But unlike Nazism, religious totalitarianism can't be fought by armies alone. It must be fought in schools and mosques, churches and synagogues, and can be defeated only with the help of imams, rabbis, and priests. The generals we need to fight this war are not Norman Schwarzkopf or even Colin Powell, but rather people like Rabbi David Hartman. From the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, what first attracted me to Rabbi Hartman when I reported from Jerusalem was his contention that unless Jews reinterpreted their faith in a way that embraced modernity without weakening religious passion and in a way that affirmed that God speaks multiple languages and is not exhausted by just one faith, they would have no future in the land of Israel. He impressed me that he also knew where the battlefield was. He set up his own schools in Israel to compete with the fundamentalist Jews, Muslims, and Christians who use their schools to preach exclusivist religious visions. In other words, he's talking about you and me. Orthodox Jews, the Taliban, it's all one and the same. It's religious totalitarianism. If you believe in the absolute truth of your belief, then you're an absolutist religious totalitarianism. And therefore, Hartman had to set up his institute in Israel because we're going to have people who are hopefully going to help us with the Muslims, and he is helping us with the Jews. He then he writes here in part that I did not include on the sheet that after the Taliban had destroyed all of those, if you remember, there was all these statues, the statues in Afghanistan, and they destroyed them. So he called up his Rebbe Hartman, and he asks him, what's going to be? You know, is that right or is that wrong? What's going to be? What's going to be in Israel and Judaism? And he answered, all faiths that come out of the biblical tradition, Judaism and Christianity, have a tendency, Nebuch, that's my addition, to believe that they have the exclusive truth. But the Taliban wiped out the Buddha statues, that's what they were saying, but others have said that too. The opposite of religious totalitarianism is an ideology of pluralism, the idea that my faith can be nurtured without claiming exclusive truth. Now this, he ends, and this I'll give to Friedman, it's a beautifully written sentence. The future of the world may be decided for how we fight this war. Can Islam, Christianity, Judaism know that God speaks Arabic on Fridays, Hebrew on Sundays, and Saturdays, and Latin on Sundays, that he welcomes different human beings that approach him? What do we have to do? We have to reinterpret their traditions to embrace modernity and pluralism, secularism even, and alternative faiths. Other Christian and Jewish fundamentalists have rejected this notion, and that is what the battle is about within their faiths. It's an unbelievable thing. I just want to point out, even though I don't agree with it at all, it's an unbelievable thing. This was an op-ed piece in the New York Times. I mean, the world read this. And again, I assume at the Hartman Institute, this is a front and center. And when he goes to fundraise, this is the first thing he gives people. I would. Here you have Mamet, one of the most chashuva op-ed writers in the world, writing a whole piece how the new war is going to be won with generals such as Rabbi David Hartman.
Yehoshua's uncle.
Oh, Yehoshua, and, well, they're cousins. Yes, 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 they're cousins, correct. St. Louis. Now, the issue, the reason I raise this or bring this to their attention is because this is another expression of the same idea that we were speaking about with Dabru Emet, or the whole issue of reciprocity. What do I mean by that? Because there is a tremendous instinct. It's part of the Zeitgeist. Again, I don't want to confuse. I'm not talking about the same issue anymore. We've moved on to a new issue, but I think there's a common thread. And the common thread, which is all around us in today's day and age, is that the problems are when people maintain that whatever they believe in is true, and that the way to solve the problems, whether it's in the Mideast, the culture war with Islamic terrorism, or for that matter, Judaism and Catholicism and their millennial strife, the way to solve all of that is to blur the differences. Again, it's black on white in Friedman, at least. If it's not black on white, which I think it is, but if it's inferred in Dabru Emet, it is revealed for everyone in Friedman's article. And again, for those who are familiar with Rabbi Hartman's works, you know that this is an accurate representation of what he thinks. That it's all about multiple truths. No one has an exhaustive bias over the truth. Everyone can be true. We have to speak a different language, etc., etc. So I would maintain two things. Number one is that that entire premise is false. Certainly it's not something that I think as an Orthodox Jew we could abide by stating. And secondly, I would also suggest that it's also not effective. Telling people that they all the things that they've always really believed in are really only perhaps, possibly, maybe true, and no better than what everyone else really, really always thought that they believed in, is usually ineffective. I want to give you an example. There were much discussion of this Friedman piece, but I was actually able to find the next week, the first week in December, in the Jerusalem Post, Jonathan Rosenblum published the piece. Many of you are familiar with the name Jonathan Rosenblum. He writes from Israel. He was a Yale-educated lawyer who became a Baal Tshuva, moved to Israel, and he heads what's called Am Echad, which I believe is an affiliate or an offshoot of the Aguda, which was originally involved in issues when the Israeli Supreme Court and others in Israel were trying to separate religion and state. It was originally founded by a number of philanthropists in America to try to combat that. And then even though that issue has been on the burner, back burner, it has still maintained its existence. I'm not sure what they do other than the fact that he, who is very talented, goes around the country speaking and writing in many places. In fact, one of the places that publishes his syndicate columns once a month is this house. The Baltimore Jewish Times. So I don't know if this piece was in the Baltimore Jewish Times. You have to go back in 2001. But Rosenblum wrote a piece in the Jerusalem Post entitled Tom Friedman's Latest Big Idea. You'll note the sarcasm in his title. Friedman cites his Rebbe David Hartman to the effect that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all have a tendency to believe that they have the exclusive truth, a sin he labels religious totalitarianism. Again, he fails to note the many basic differences in the biblical faith. I would add, it's not just that Judaism doesn't try to have converts, we haven't blown up the World Trade Center yet either. Again, there's a major difference, which for some reason Rosenblum misses. Even if you think that it's terrible that we believe in the truth of what we think, we haven't exactly carried it out historically or contemporarily the way that others who believe absolutely in their beliefs have. The progressive religion advocated by Friedman Hartman turns out to be highfalutin gibberish. Like good postmodernists, Friedman Hartman called for a multilingual view of God that reduces differences, different religions to nothing more than a series of narratives, human beings approaching God out of their different history, language, and cultural perspective. The Friedman Hartman redefinition of religion is an assault on the very concept of truth. Jesus cannot be both divine and not divine. The covenant between God and the Jewish people cannot be simultaneously intact and superseded. Muhammad cannot have been a prophet and not have received prophecy. For Friedman Hartman, however, any proposition and its opposite are equally valid, and it's all a matter of narrative perspective. Somehow, according to Friedman, man-made narratives need not weaken religious passion. And I don't want to dwell on this back and forth in the op-ed pages too much, but again, I think whatever you're convinced, whichever one of these pieces pull you, it's another front and another expression, in my opinion, of a similar phenomenon, which is that you have, again, in different contexts, dueling views, and perhaps part of the duel is in the strategy of how to solve some of these problems. And one of the, again, very popular theories in many contexts in our day and age is this idea of relativism, of I'm okay, you're okay, of blurring the lines. And that was Levinson's critique of Davar Emet, and I think an accurate critique by Rosenblum of Friedman's op-ed.
Can I ask a question? He's criticizing the extreme Orthodox Jewish view. I don't think that the extreme Orthodox Jewish view wants to convert all the world to
Of course,
Jewish.
Of course. That's what Rosenblum says.
Right, but I'm saying that's not the truth.
I know. I know.
So,
you have a shiloh on Tom Friedman? I got many. I subscribe still to the Times. I get shiloh on him every week.
No, I have a shiloh on Hartman. I mean, is he really
okay,
saying...
Okay, this is not for now. This is not for now.
Is he really
okay.
saying...
Okay, I don't know what he's... I know that he has said, and many times has said things like this.
I mean,
what does he mean by it? What does he really believe? I don't know.
No, but you believe that they should still continue to worship the way they worship. They're worshiping. They're not going to become Jewish, the non-Jewish people. So their way of worshiping is still could be the same God. It's just that they're worshiping differently.
I don't know. Okay, I don't want to get too well. Yeah, he's published many books. You know, I could even give you a bibliography if you're interested. And again, he's... Baruch Hashem, I said this once about something that happened in the yeshiva, where one of the Rosh Yeshivas had said something, written something, and some other people years later were analyzing it and criticizing it. And part of the issue was, did the Rosh Yeshiva really mean it or not? So I said to one of my friends, I said, you know, when we argue about what the Rambam meant, so that's all we can do. But I said, Baruch Hashem, for 120, he's still around. He's right up in front of the Beis Medrash. If you're not sure what he thought, go ask him. Somebody's alive and around, it's menschlich to go to them, especially if you disagree with them, and find out what do they think. So Baruch Hashem, David Hartman is alive and well, living in Yerushalayim, in our Kodesh. You know, there's more ways to analyze him. I don't want to get too down again. Needless to say, this and many other points of his personal philosophy are not in keeping with my personal thinking, but he's certainly a very consequential thinker and leader in the world, really, and in Yerushalayim. The more you agree with him, the more you're happy about that fact. And the opposite, obviously, is also true. I have a major faux pas to point out to you, which is that the two sources here that are on the top right and the bottom left, diagonally here on this page, are mislabeled. The one on the bottom left is from Rabbi Karmi, and the one on the top right is from Meir Soloveitchik. Now, they were close. Meir and I were students of Rabbi Karmi together, and I think they probably both agree with each other, but each one should get credit or not for what they said. So that's my mistake. I only realized that about an hour ago. The Rabbi Karmi article, which is on the bottom left, comes from the same yet-to-be-published article in First Things, again, the Catholic Theological Journal. Again, you'll see the date, 2005, Abba Aleinu Letova. He sent me a copy. It has not yet been published yet. We discussed many quotes from that last week. He basically makes the point, as does my friend Meir Soloveitchik on the top right, which is the following, which is that as we move now slightly more even into another topic or arena, again, we're blowing by, we're just touching on many different issues. As I said, there's really not enough time to do all these justice. But one of the issues seems to be, and this is where we touch a little bit on the politics, but certainly even in a broader sense of politics, just in culture, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish community seems to be incredibly uncomfortable having anything to do with the Christians, or certainly with Catholics, even in areas where it's demonstrable that we actually have what to say in common or similar positions with them. Now, why should that be? So if you're looking for a more general cultural or academic explanation and critique of that, that's on the bottom left from Rabbi Karmi, where he points out that even though we have much, you know, dissimilar from the secular world, we have no problem, as he says, dancing with the secular world, and yet we can't write, we talk about or take seriously Catholic thought or positions. And his basic theory is it has to do with the discrimination against anything religious. They were much more willing to, you know, embrace issues or people who have a secularist mindset than people who we may also have very disagreements with, but since they're coming from a religious perspective, that makes many modern Jews and modern people very uncomfortable. It's a very interesting perspective. On the top right, again, that's not Rabbi Karmi, that's Meir Soloveitchik, he also is reiterating a similar idea, again, in focusing on the fact that, as we saw from last week, in the first week, or Soloveitchik did say there are some things we should be doing, or they thought were good, and that was getting together and having dialogue on all sorts of issues relating to social, moral issues. Now, that does not presuppose that we're going to agree with them. The fact that we happen, and again, in very demonstrative ways, to agree with them on certain issues is besides the point. He was suggesting we should dialogue with them on any of these social or moral issues, And it certainly goes to the point, and this is what the Meir Soloveitchik calls for, is to us to be proactive. Again, it's not just theoretical anymore, Lamaisa, be proactive in joining them in what, again, is sometimes not used, certainly not in the Orthodox community too much, Tikkun Olam, to help make the world a better, more moral place. And that there's no reason that our partners in some of these things can't be people who are not Jewish.
That's not what Rav Moshe is saying. Rav Moshe is not disagreeing with that necessarily.
Correct. Rav Moshe was talking about these conventions, what he calls committees, and other things. Right. The fact that there should be political involvement, so if you read the newspapers, you know that not only the OU, but also the Aguda is very involved in these type of things, and I'm sure that even on a local level, all parts of Orthodox community, most notably now Yisrael, has been very involved with the local church on many areas of common concern. That's a political issue, and that's the final issue I want to touch now, which is that in addition to the more highfalutin, general philosophical, theological issues we spent a lot of time discussing from Soloveitchik, even some of the more cultural issues now that Rabbi Karmi and others are referring to, this whole general issue of is believing in absolutely that you're right or not, is that a bad thing like Friedman thinks, or is there room for more relativism, etc.? All of that, there's one final issue, again, it's not identical, but in my opinion, it's all part of this whole puzzle, that is the very practical issue of politics. Should we be partnering with non-Jews, specifically Christians, and what is now known in America as the Christian right, for two reasons. Number one, because with their support of Israel. Number two is even on social moral issues, in which if it would be so determined, and I don't want to get into which ones would and wouldn't be, but if it would be so determined on issue X or Y, or within issue X, we agree with them about part or whole, should we be partnering with them, or should we view, and they clearly do want to partner with us, or should we view this as a very bad thing, a red flag, and be very scared about being partnered with them, or even generally the whole idea of interjecting religion into contemporary cultural and political debate? So this, I don't need to tell anybody here, is a major hot-button issue. I'm not going to do it justice or even attempt to in the remaining 5 minutes, but I just want to give you as an example, because there's no question that in the current landscape, partially still within the Orthodox community, but certainly to an overwhelming extent in the non-Orthodox community, there is a major and a very strong feeling that, to paraphrase the comment made about the Vatican 2 weeks ago, that we shouldn't just walk, but we should run away from any such discussions, partnerships, or coalitions. There's no question that, at least today and age, is the predominant view of Jewish individuals in America, and certainly most of the major Jewish organizations, the AJC and the ADL, etc., are all very much opposed to any of these things. Just to give you an example, and again, I get no money from them, I'm not on their list, but as an example, against anybody's interested, as one of the minority that strongly takes the opposite view, I just brought to your attention here on the bottom right this mission statement, which comes from the organization out of Seattle called Torah Tradition, which is actually run by an Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Lapin. I believe this is a cousin of our Lapin's. And he and his brother are very interesting, provocative thinkers. They're English, actually. And on their website, TorahTradition.org, they give you their mission statement, which is a lot longer than this. But I give you a few of their basic ideas, and they're very upfront about it. To work to advance our nation, that means America, towards the traditional Judeo-Christian values that defined America's creation and became the blueprint for her greatness, believe that only a new alliance of concerned citizens can re-identify and dramatically strengthen the core values necessary for America to maintain the greatness and moral leadership. Concerned Jews share this objective with many evangelical and conservative Christians. Working together, they focus on a common cultural and moral and political goals. Torah Tradition offers an integrated philosophical and moral cultural vision, one that is rooted in Torah, American history, and the Judeo-Christian values reflected in that history. And again, this is not just a mission statement. This is tangible, not only in speeches and things that he's said and given, but actual things that he's done. You won't be surprised that many in the current administration are very big fans of his. So if you go to the website, you will see Rabbi Lapin's address at a private dinner with President in Seattle. It's not surprising that a Jew of this background, the things that he's done, the money that he's raised, obviously, by and large, has a lot more friends in the Republican Party than he does in the Democratic Party. In fact, it's interesting. If you go to that speech, he writes, "I cannot affirmatively convey that God is a Republican, but," and then he goes on to say why he still thinks that we should be supporting George Bush. It was a very kind of a cute line. Again, it's only in that kind of, in any other part of the Jewish community, he'd be shot for even making the statement. But again, among, in that case, friends, so he made that, obviously, kind of a cute joke. It's an interesting philosophy, obviously one that is very controversial in the Jewish community. I want to close by just turning your attention, we won't read this inside for the sake of time, because you can all read it yourself, especially if any of you get Jewish Action, which if you don't, I encourage you to get. Again, I get nothing from the promo, but this is the OU's semi-annual magazine. The shul gets its own copy as an OU shul. Anyone wants to borrow it, happy to lend it to you.
Quarterly,
thank you very much. Four times a year. The most recent issue, it just came in the mail last week. One of the lead articles on the cover is Judaism and the Christian Right. And the truth is they present what appears to be a debate, but if you read it, it's not a total debate, although it's a slight difference of opinion, between two writers. One is none other than Rabbi Lapin of Torah Tradition fame. And the other, the first one on the top right, is Rabbi Michael Skoback. Anyone familiar with the name? He is the head of the Toronto branch of Jews for Judaism. Now, why you think they have him writing? Because one of the main fears of getting involved with all of this stuff, even on a political level, is they only want to join forces with us. They're only supporting Israel because they ultimately want to convert us. And there's no question that this Rabbi Skoback thinks that that is a real fear, something which Rabbi Lapin obviously thinks is less of a fear. But the truth is, if you read the whole essay, again, I'll just point your attention to the bottom right-hand, left-hand column here to the middle, where he speaks about the fact that Jews most of the time have misinterpreted and misevaluated the Christian Right's support for Israel. The general assumption is they believe in it just because that's the only way for the Second Coming to happen. While some believe that, most do not. And even those who believe it, it's only one small piece in the puzzle. He gives you many other reasons. And he's the one who's somewhat critical of it. But he gives you many other reasons, a more sophisticated and knowledgeable understanding has to be, for why so many Christians recently, not the liberal Christians, the liberal Christians are from the vocal critics of Jews, of Israel right now, the Protestants, etc. But the more conservative Christians have been the biggest supporters of Israel in the current day and age. And ultimately, if you read the last paragraph here, I'm in the middle of the thing, he ultimately doesn't have a radical, he's not antagonistic. He has a kind of a middle position. He has all these issues back and forth. What this calls for in practice is a delicate policy of chabdehu v'chashdehu, appreciative engagement and careful scrutiny when dealing with evangelicals. In other words, we should partner with them to a certain extent, but we should, he says, be suspicious. Keep our eyes open, keep our guard up. Again, it's certainly not a radical anti-view, but he's certainly very aware and thinks that there are definitely serious fears. Rabbi Lapin has, again, a lot of stuff here. I only mentioned some things, a very long article. One of the things he mentions, which is so interesting, is that he is mechaven to Charlie Arian. He mentions this whole idea that if we get involved with this stuff, it'll lead to intermarriage. And then he says very strongly, he thinks it's all wrong. No Jew is going to go off the derech and go convert for Jews for Judaism because the Christians are supporting Israel. He says they're going because they don't know enough about Judaism. And he writes it very, very beautifully. You know, when Jewish Americans know the name of Jesus' mother, but not of Moses' mother, when they read the Bible, when they can't even read the Bible in its original Hebrew, when they find more word in a Christian community than a Jewish one, it is a Jewish, not a Christian problem. Christian leaders, among them Reverend Jerry Falwell, have told me the evangelistic efforts are not effective among observant and Torah-educated Jews. The more a Jew knows, the more a Jew is educated in his own tradition, the less likely is that he's going to feel the emptiness that would want, perhaps, to attract him. Again, very interesting. I'm just giving it to your attention. And I want to close with the way he closes his own article, which is an unbelievable story that he personally witnessed and participated in, coming from Cheskel Bromsky. Lapin, again, he's been living in America for many years. The whole opening of this article is why, when he came to America to visit, how he fell in love with the religiosity of America. He doesn't mean the Jewish religiosity, and that's why he never left. He grew up in England. He studied in yeshivas in Gateshead. He had a very interesting background. And he speaks about the fact that we know that the Dayan, Cheskel Bromsky, he was a Talmud of Reb Chaim Brisker, huge, huge gone after he was sent to Russia and was in Siberia. Eventually he was released. He was in England for a few years before eventually going to Eretz Yisrael before he died. And when he was in England, so Rabbi Lapin tells a story about how he attended a public lecture on the Holocaust at which Rabbi Abramsky refuted the notion that anti-Semitism was somehow endemic to Germans. A member of the audience agreeing suggested that true, the Holocaust could really have happened anywhere. But then he remembered Rabbi Abramsky's debt of gratitude towards the British government with sensitivity towards the Jewish principle of gratitude. He added, except England, of course. And Rabbi Abramsky looked very sadly at the speaker and said, no, even in England, before the stunned London audience could recover, Rabbi Abramsky continued, but probably not in America. Years later, learning at Yeshivas Kol Torah in Yerushalayim, I often visited with Rabbi Abramsky at his home in that city where he had retired. More than once I referred back to that London lecture, and I asked him, why not in America? He would only smile at me and repeat, no, no, not in America. No, not in America. I'm not saying that all things will forever be good. We are in Golos, even in America. However, there is no mitzvah to accelerate bad times. Let's not behave in the foolish ways prohibited by our sages that, God forbid, could turn friends into enemies and undo Rabbi Abramsky's optimistic prophecy. Again, we're in on a political level. We're now in a very precarious position. Even if you wish, even if you think it's wrong that they're doing this and they have the worst motives, but we're in a precarious position, which is very similar to the theological position that we find ourselves in when it comes to that side of the debate, which is if they're reaching out to us and being so friendly to us, so how does that look if we turn our back towards that? Now, what the therefore is will have to be decided by people much wiser than me. But there's no question that that has to be a factor put into the equation. As even this other fellow, Rabbi Skobek, opens up his article, there's this tempest, there's this storm, rising anti-Semitism, the UN, the academic community, etc., etc., etc. And out of that storm, what's the one light? Christian conservatives. Now that, to me, is an accurate description of the current reality. So if you think that that's a bad thing, maybe you're right. But then the question is, if we turn our back even on them, leave aside the practical issue of the fact that we then have no friends, how do you think that's going to make them feel? And the truth is, Rabbi Lapin gives many examples where he's friends with these people and say, how come the Jews are always so against us? He gives an example, when there are more Jews in Hindu cults and other things, than the greatest percentage of non-Easterners in Eastern religions in the world are Jews. And how come there's not an organization comparable to Jews for Judaism against Jews for Buddhism? Because we have the opposite of a soft spot in our community for Christianity. There's no question about it. And they know that, and they're upset at us. So what's the therefore? I don't know. These are very serious and real questions. And the only thing I would say is I'm not at all convinced, again, it's not a theory, it's consistent in what the Rav himself had said, that the fact that we would be against being involved theologically and think that theologically, if we would involve ourselves, that would create problems with reciprocity, etc., does not at all, in theory, negate being involved in them with all these other moral issues, and I assume support for Israel would at least be as important as discussing issues of nuclear war. Namely, that again, you might be against both. It's a separate issue. But it's not necessarily one connected to the other. Haraya, the Rav, did not think that they were connected. And he felt that we should be involved in these types of discussions. Now, he's not around now. There was no evangelical great movement. It's a much more recent phenomenon in the 60s, or even when he was alive and functioning. Who knows what he would say? I can't pretend to know. But certainly one wouldn't use the first part of his essay as a basis to be against. If anything, and this is what his great-nephew, Meir Soloveitchik, did in that Forward article, he uses the second part of his essay to promote, and saying we should be involved with Christians on moral issues. But again, like everything, there's risks. It's a double-edged sword. And like everything that's part of our galus, it just has now found most of the Jewish community in the world, in America, more than any other place in the diaspora. We always have to realize that we're always in a precarious position. That's the nature of galus. I think Rabbi Lapin is obviously correct about that. We are now in perhaps the most wonderful nation we ever had. And perhaps even as Diane Abramsky said, all the terrible things that happened throughout Christian Europe could never happen in America. Maybe he's right. But that doesn't mean that things will always be good or are guaranteed to be good. There's no question we have to be careful. But what does careful mean? Does careful mean to be far away? Does careful mean to be close? Are we really natural allies on certain things or not? These are all very, very real questions which continue to be debated, continue to have absolute practical and contemporary resonance. And I hope, again, that the last 3 weeks that we've studied together perhaps have contributed by creating a fuller understanding not only of the framework that started already 40 years ago, but perhaps, I think, again, this is all my own speculation, but perhaps there that is the correct prism through which to view, again, whatever conclusion one reaches, some of the contemporary issues that are currently facing us in what is almost always another example of Ace Tzara Liyakov, some of the many contemporary challenges that we have. I want to just close by mentioning that somebody this week asked me if I would get really, really practical, which had to do with, you know, how should Jews handle Christmas office parties and stuff like that. So the answer was that I was not prepared and didn't plan necessarily on discussing it, but anyone who has such a shaila should certainly come and see me. That would be yet another example of a reminder of all the issues that we all face living in a, not in Eretz Yisrael, living in the diaspora. And certainly we hope that Emirat Hashem, this wonderful host country that we have and all of our relationships, whether it's with the priests in the country, the reverends in the country, or just our neighbors and co-workers, should hopefully always be to fulfill Darkei Shalom, and our role as an Orla Gaim should be continued to be enhanced, and in no way, God forbid, diminished. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
And everybody's invited next week, Matzah Shabbos, back for a game of Texas Hold'em to celebrate Nitzelnacht, which is not really Friday night, I guess it's Nitzelnacht.